Hi, you're listening to Talking About Organizations, a podcast about management and organization studies, brought to you through the support of the School of Business, Management, and Economics at the University of Sussex. This is episode 33, where we're going to discuss Roethlisberger's 1945 article that appeared in the Harvard Business Review, The Foreman, Master and Victim of Double Talk. To get this text and for more information, please visit our website at www.talkingaboutorganizationsnospaces.com. My name is Ralph, and I have two other members of the team with me.
This is Pedro, coming to you from the University of Warwick in the UK.
And this is Joe, coming to you from Melbourne, Florida.
Oh man, I thought you were going to say Australia there for a second.
Me too, yeah.
So this is Ralph in Albuquerque, New Mexico. Welcome, everybody, to the first episode of Season 4. Before we begin, I would like to acknowledge a couple of things. First of all, you may have noticed now that we have a new sponsor. This is very exciting, and we are very thankful to the Department of Business, Management, and Economics at the University of Sussex for supporting the podcast from now on. This is a collaboration we are very much looking forward to, not only because producing a podcast such as this one can be surprisingly resource-intensive, their support not only means that we can continue to grow, but also keep the show free and without ads, which we think is important. Special thank you goes out to Professors Stephen McGuire and Susan Newell for making this happen. We would also like to give our most sincere thanks to our previous supporter, the Icon Research Center at the University of Warwick. Even though we part ways now, it's important to remember that there is a good chance this podcast would not exist if it weren't for Icon stepping in to support us from as early as episode 2. I think Icon can take pride in what they helped accomplish here. And an individual thank you goes to Professors Jackie Swan and David Nicolini, as well as Don Cotton, for placing their faith and trust in what, at the time, was probably a very unconventional idea. Thanks for being willing to experiment, Icon, and for all your support.
Yes, thank you to Icon and to our new sponsors at the University of Sussex. A brief announcement before we get to the discussion. Some of our listeners may know that as the podcast evolved, we also evolved a more sophisticated internal structure to help manage things more efficiently and to put at least some of what we are reading to good use. I think that would be the principle of internal elaboration. According from season 4 onwards, we instituted a rotating chair to the podcast. So please join me in congratulating Ralph as the first ever chair of Talking About Organizations podcast.
Hooray!
Thank you!
Even though this is almost completely an internal development, we wanted to share this very exciting milestone with you, our lovely listeners, and to congratulate Ralph on stepping up to take responsibility of running the podcast. So, after what is likely the longest introduction to an episode in the history of the podcast, shall we get down to the discussion?
Yes, please.
Yes, great idea. I'm going to give a brief introduction to the article that we've chosen.
Mm-hmm.
The late F.J. Roethlisberger was the Wallace Brett Dunham Professor of Human Relations at the Harvard Business School. He's the author of Man in the Organization, which was published by Harvard University Press in 1968. Together with John Dixon, he published the first comprehensive findings of the Hawthorne experiments in 1937. We have mentioned the Hawthorne experiments many times on the show.
Mm-hmm. Like in episode 9.
Yeah, that's true.
In which we discussed a text by Elton Mayo.
Right, and also, I forget the episode number, but the one where we mentioned Bernard, and Bernard's going to come up today. In this article, Roethlisberger described the nature of the position the foreman occupied in industrial organizations post-World War II and the role confusion they faced. Foremen have to communicate management demands for efficiency and change to the workers. Usually these are based on what might be called the logics of evaluation, but they also have to be sensitive to the feelings of the people that work for them to motivate them.
So I think what is interesting on this text, thinking all the different things we have read throughout the podcast and the position of this text in the history of management organizational studies, is that it is first, as we said before, linked to the overall human relations school. But at the same time, I think it adds a different dimension, because it has a very clear link to what are the consequences of a Tayloristic system in place. So at the same time, it's almost like the emergence of an attention for informal processes of social dynamics. And also look at the same time, what has the Taylorism done to industrial organizations? So I think there is this dual conversation happening. And I think it's particularly interesting, this text, is it has been selected by HBR itself as a classic. So it was actually republished, I think, 15, 20 years after it was first published. So, you know, it is an affirmed classic, so to speak, even in the canon itself, which makes it, you know, perfect for us.
Right. I think that's a great point. And as he starts out the article, you can tell he's describing a lot of things that are going on in organizations of his day, post-World War II, and there are some descriptions that I think if you adjust them slightly, they would be similar to organizations today. Post-World War II, or actually even during World War II, you had this huge influx of workers who had not worked in factories before to replace the people that were serving in uniform. And if you look at today, we have something similar in that the baby boom generation in all the Western industrialized countries is retiring. So you have this large influx of younger workers. And because the generation immediately after the baby boomers is about half the size of the baby boomers, you're getting a lot of people coming in from the following generation who have much less experience in the workplace. And then they also have they grew up as digital natives, which people in the baby boom didn't, and are adjusting to these changes in the workplace. So I think there's many parallels, even though the time is different.
For me, I think the strong parallel is many of the things that he was trying to raise awareness within, I would say, the management scholarship in general, are still worthy of attention. I think we still have not learned the lesson very well, you know, at least in the mainstream literature, at least.
That's a good point. And I thought your observation that relates very closely to Taylorisms. He makes a statement here. He doesn't actually invoke Taylor, but early in the article, he makes a statement that management chickens have come home to roost, right? Which is a nice way to sum up what you said, Pedro, about this idea of breaking down and de-skilling the work and the impact that has, because, you know, Taylor tended to view workers' motivation being primarily financial. You know, the workers would put up with this change in the nature of the work and it breaking it down and de-skilling it because you could pay them more. And that's all over Taylor's writing and speeches. And it's clear that from Roethlisberger's writing, but also from what we've seen from Mayo and others, that they believe that social factors and social needs are just as important for the workers and that money alone is not a pure motivator. And there's, you know, Maslow has research that indicates that money makes a difference up to a certain point, and then beyond a certain point, it really doesn't make much of a difference. So one of the things I thought was interesting about the article is he does a very good description of the foreman's job of the day. And as I was reading the article, he's describing how the foreman has to respond to the needs of the boss and the people in administration, the people who set targets and goals, and all these very logical kind of normative descriptions of what should go on in the organization, and also the need to change. And I was thinking, all right, I think you could substitute the word middle manager, you know, for today's work with foreman, and you would not be too far off the mark about what the conflicts are, these difficulties that the managers face.
Yes, I totally agree.
So I found interesting his list of 14 items that the foreman is required to do, having had various positions where a large number of foremen, or in our parlance, supervisor, first level supervisor, were basically below me. The list is pretty steady in terms of those 14 items would pretty adequately describe what I would have expected my first level supervisors to be able to accomplish.
That's a great point, Joe. When he was providing that list, I was thinking, how is that any different than today? I mean, we might have brought in a few more things, but I was thinking about my time in the shipyard and the things that we expect foremen to do. And I also remember as a junior member of the shipyard management team, I was awed by all those things foremen were expected to accomplish.
I think I want to frame this issue within a historical context, because, well, I think I was not so clear at the beginning. So I think what he's trying to describe here is what is happening in what you call the modern foreman position. And I think you have to understand that what he has in mind is the old school pre-Taylor situation in which everything is more craft-based.
Yeah.
In which the foreman has a strong tie with the workers. He's kind of, you know, a leader of the workers that is responsible to decide with the workers the kind of output that's going to happen and how they're going to go about the work. But then, as we know, and as we discussed in the first episode, actually, there is Taylor in which he takes away that autonomy and gives all the, I would say, functions of planning, of designing the process, of establishing the output to a number of specialists, and give the foreman merely, I would say, the supervision function, in which he's like the agent of compliance. He needs to make sure that the worker is being done.
That's a great observation. And he does reference that time of working 25 years ago, that he's really focused on that kind of a change from the crafts-based. So, Pedro, that was a good point, and I think it helps frame the context of our discussion better. And later in the article, Roethlisberger talks about not only that aspect of transmitting downward, you know, the direction of these specialists and other foremen for the work, but he also talks about the fact that the supervisor, and this is something I thought was very interesting, the supervisor has to pay attention to what his boss wants, and very close attention. The expression you often hear in the workforce, and I know I've heard it quoted to me several times by superiors, what interests my boss fascinates me. And so Roethlisberger's writing about that. One way to say this, curry favor with the boss. To emphasize that, Roethlisberger makes a statement. Everything that he does, that is the foreman, he tries to evaluate in terms of his superior's reaction. Everything the superior does, he tries to evaluate in terms of what it implies about his superior's relation to him. Now, that when I was reading that, I thought, well, that may be true, but in my work experience, I think that varies by person. And so he's making a generalization, and I understand. But I think not only have I worked for people where I wasn't exactly in tune with everything they wanted, and sometimes when you get more experienced, you feel like you can disagree or have contrary thoughts without it causing great friction. But I've also worked with people that were nominally my subordinates who many times didn't seem to be too interested in what I had to say and had their own agenda. And so I think that's simplification. I don't think it's invalid. I just think you have to realize that varies.
I understand. I have the same feeling, and I think the problem lies that, well, I understand the text is an essay, so he doesn't give a lot of, you know, empirical stories. So it's hard to understand what exactly this characterization is based upon, or, you know, how does it play out.
And to supplement Pedro there, I went through the same logic but put that question on hold. And if you look at the administrative descriptions, the six elements of the quote-unquote administrator, we probably fit into that and therefore don't quite amongst ourselves have the total experience that Roethlisberger saw, especially from his interviews that he did at the various plants.
Mm-hmm. I think you're probably right about that, Joe, and we'll go into that when we get to that part of the article. And so it's at this point in the article where he talks about these different competing demands that the foreman has to satisfy, that he basically makes a statement, he's the master of double talk, right? And I think that bears a little bit of deconstruction, because double talk usually conveys a notion of somebody who's not truthful or duplicitous, or, you know, says one thing to somebody and one thing to somebody else. And so maybe literally there's this one thing to somebody like your boss, you know, to have one conversation with your boss. And then you have this a different conversation with the people that work for you, because the nature of what you're trying to accomplish is different with these two different relationships. So in that sense, yes, you're having two different kinds of conversations. I'm not sure I got the notion that it was not being truthful with people, though.
I think it's more to do with the interface. You know, it's the foreman, the way he describes this position, which could be the middle manager today, is the moment in which labor and management interface. Because at the same time, he has an allegiance towards management, understood as, you know, the ones that control and decide how the work should be done. But at the same time, they are in the front line dealing with the workers and having to, you know, make them comply with the decisions and the ideas of management. But, you know, so that's why it has to navigate this this double role almost.
Yeah, I think that's a good way to say it. And so I'm not arguing with his choice of words. I just thought it was important to bring it up. And I think you make a good point there. One of the things I noticed during my working career was that it actually didn't work very well if you went to the subordinates and said exactly what management said, you know, exactly what you were told. That didn't work very well. And in fact, Joe and I can both say that our personal experiences in the Navy, you're actually encouraged not to do that. And there's a story or vignette, or and sometimes it's written down, called the XOSED. XO stands for executive officer, so second in command of the ship. And they give examples of a junior officer or someone saying, well, we have to do this because the XO said to do so, or we have to do this because the executive officer said we had to do so. And then what I believe, and I'd be interested to hear Joe's conclusion here, but I believe the moral to that vignette that's taught to people in the Navy for leadership skills is that if that's all you're doing is just transmitting what the XO said, then you're not really a leader. You're just a mouthpiece. Mm-hmm. You could be replaced by a microphone or somebody writing something down.
Roethlisberger did not use this word probably because it wasn't yet developed. But when he talked about the dilemma of the foreman having to keep the superior informed yet communicate with his subordinates, and that's where the double speak is created. That's a variation of a double bind.
Mm, yeah. Oh, yeah, it's good.
And so that's the underlying part. And then later on, when two paragraphs later, where he talks about the foreman wanting to be loyal and wanting to be secure, that's a variation of what's called Ephrat's cloud, where people want to both be secure and have good results.
Yes.
Where they take risk. And so the description between those three paragraphs captures either a double blind or Ephrat's cloud as where the foreman is stuck and without the knowledge or tools to break the cloud, they just keep going through the cycle over and over again, which is, where I was headed towards in this paper.
I was also going to offer a different understanding of what double talk to me means in this article. I didn't read it so much as the challenge of the foreman per se of, what he has to communicate and what he has to accomplish, but more the general problem in which in organizations, at least the ones that I studied, I think traditional large organizations face this problem in which information goes up the hierarchy, and as it goes up, it tends to be edited because, of course, the person carrying the message and carrying the results, it's afraid that, if you present how the situation really is, the people in the higher echelons are going to be, of course, very upset and, then up, being the ones liable for the problem because they were more or less the ones that are responsible for the activities on the ground. And also there is this tendency of embellishment, which creates this problem because at the same time you have to be true to what is really happening, but at the same time you don't want to burn yourself in the process.
Yeah, that's a great observation. And I think we discussed that some with Professor Mintzberg when we were talking about his book and about how senior leaders are aware of this filtering. Yes. Many times, and one of their biggest struggles is getting candid observations about what's really going on from people because of this tendency to self-censor that you mentioned, Pedro. I think that's a good point.
So I'm looking for it right now, and this might be premature, but the paper was focused for almost its whole extent on the foreman.
Yes.
And then near the end, Roethlisberger, he extended the argument to every level. Essentially an argument of recursion.
Yes, that's true.
And so we've kind of touched on it, and I was hoping that he would because, while he had significant details in his thousands of interviews involved, I'm sure, many foremen, the problem is general and does extend through the organization. And if we were only to apply it to foremen, life would get somewhat better, but not truly as good as it could. And it does apply up and down the whole hierarchy that Pedro mentioned.
What is the problem that you see, that applies all across?
It's the double bind. It's the double talk. It's the...
Okay.
If we stick to this article, it's the message from above must be translated to those below, and the carrier of the message must understand all of the constraints and filters through which the message must be translated in order to achieve the organization's desired results.
Yeah, that's a great way to say it, because I think a lot of people in organizations, at least this was my personal experience, and I think there's some research to back this up, often feel like at the senior levels, I just give this command and stuff's going to happen. And in fact, there's a great quote from a Peter Block book that says, you have the power to tell me what to do. I have the power to decide whether to do it or not. And so many times, what you really want as a senior leader is you don't want strict compliance with exactly what you said to do. You want them to get the idea, and that's what we're seeing in a knowledge worker, and I'm going to bring that up later. But in the world that Roethlisberger is talking about, that's less of an issue because it's more about do these things, do these tasks, you know, turn the lathe this way, you know, those kinds of things. So it seems to me, like Joe was saying earlier in the article, he's talking about a lot more concrete stuff. And I'm like you, Joe, when I wasn't getting frustrated, but I was just wondering, is he going to bring up other aspects of how the organization works in bureaucracy? And I did feel a little bit more complete near the end of the article when he does talk about how that functions at different levels. So one thing I want to bring up is it's not really useful to refer to page numbers because I got my article off the web and it may not be the same as Pedro's, but probably in the first third or so of the article, he's talking about the relations between the foreman and other members of the organization, foreman and his boss, foreman and worker, and foreman and other foreman. And he's got this great line that goes, I think, to the heart of some of what Joe was talking about as far as this double bind, about what the foreman has to do in this difficult position. And the words he used, the foreman, or according to the logic of industrial organization, there's a kind of a hint at Taylorism, must, one, uphold at the work level the standards, policies, rules, and regulations which have been originated by other groups and see to it that the workers conform to them. And at the same time, two, obtain, if possible, the workers' spontaneous cooperation to this way of doing business. And then he finishes up by saying, and then anybody who's been in such a position knows this isn't a very easy task.
Mm-hmm. Yes. And I think if we go at the heart of the matter, no, we are here at the underlying problem in which Taylorism is designed as clear-cut management of tasks that presupposes that organizations work as machines. And as we know, they don't. You know, the only way in which you can elicit cooperation is by creating leveraging and nurturing social dynamics.
Well, and social cohesion, which he talks about later in the article. Great. That's a great point. Yeah. Because he actually goes a little further in the same paragraph to say that people don't exactly want to conform, or it's not typical to get enthusiastic conformity when they have no say in the work they do, right? And that's the reference to the 25 years prior and the nature of how work had changed, right? Because he wrote this in 1945. So if he's saying 25 years earlier, 20s, that's when Taylorism was really starting to catch on.
Mm-hmm, exactly.
More to your point, Pedro, later he talks about there's these two social processes going on, right? Because this is, I thought, was a part I thought was very interesting and where I think we can get into Bernard a little bit. He said the first one of these special or these social processes, it's directly related through these logics and rational speaking and to the purposes of which, for which you have the formal organization, to, you know, producing the product, producing the thing, doing what you're supposed to do, the part, and moving on to the next part, you know, that kind of thing. And then it talks about you have the formal organization and all this logical nature of it. And then he points out that the second.
The procedures, the standards.
Yep, absolutely. And all of these things that, you know, compliance is required for. And then he says, number two, though, there are these spontaneous social processes that go on in any organized human activity, which have no specific conscious common purpose and which result in this informal organization. He says at the end of that paragraph, these attitudes and organizations are based on feeling and sentiment, which is what I believe you were talking about, Pedro. And they not only are they necessary for this feeling of belonging, which is pretty important in organizations, but he said they don't change rapidly.
I think that's also like, you know, the way he's trying to create space for the kind of work he was doing with others like Mayo, you know, saying that, you know, Taylorism has been designed that way as if everything was a machine and the functions have been designed that way, the function of the foreman in this case. But actually, it's never going to work because behind all that, the way people behave and work depends on a number of social dynamics, and you have to understand those if you want these things to happen. No, so that's why he went to study and, you know, discover and put forward the importance of looking at, you know, the so-called informal, social, and so on and so forth.
Right. And that, one of the things that reminded me of when he was talking about the social aspect of it was the comments or what Bernard wrote about.
Mm.
You know, because Bernard in chapter 9 of The Functions of the Executive, mm-hmm. he talks about the informal organization and why it's really important. And he, like Roethlisberger, he says many senior executives are completely unaware of this informal organization. But he says, and I quote, "It creates the conditions under which formal organization may arise, and informal organizations are necessary to the operation of formal organizations as a means of communication, of cohesion, and of protecting the integrity of the individual." He says that on page 123. So I think he would certainly agree with Raffelsberger on that point.
I think what is interesting, and that's what is, you know, it's interesting reading the classics, because in a way, I think management and organizational theory has evolved towards that direction. So I think the past 20 years and everything that's been written about, you know, culture and, you know, all the Toyota / Lean movement, and I don't know, a number of things related to knowledge, to knowledge economy, you know, things like communities of practice in organizations. There are all ways in which you lightly manage, but also channel and nurture all this dimension. You know, management has become much more savvy.
Yes.
Into, you know, you exploiting, you know, these feelings, attachments, all this hinterland of emotions as something that can be also actually coordinated, can be also tapped upon, you know, to achieve specific goals.
Yeah, I think that's one of the things you're seeing in modern management and leadership scholarship. Mm-hmm. Is this idea that you do have to look at the whole person, and you have to treat people like Mayo and Raffelsberger suggest as human beings, and that is actually the best way to get cooperation and commitment and trust from them. And I'll talk about that a little bit later, but I think that's key. So what's interesting here is we talk about that a lot now, but I would say that's not, we haven't always talked about that. So I would say probably from the 80s and on, you know, when we were trying to understand, well, why are the Japanese doing so much better than other companies in Western Europe and United States? And, you know, we see some of this stuff. So people would go to Japanese factories and they'd look at something like quality circles.
Yeah, exactly.
And they'd say, oh, we need to do quality circles, right? Mm-hmm. So you just got to love the way many people in manufacturing said, okay, well, we'll just do that. You know, we'll do this thing. Mm-hmm. And or we'll do, you know, some kind of worker council thing. But they didn't get the spirit, like you were talking about, Pedro, of the nature of this cooperation and treating people as individuals where their input matters. Mm-hmm. And so I think one of the things Joe and I have both seen in our working career is that people at the working level, they've got a really finely tuned detector or detectors, I guess, for double talk, right? They could really see clearly and rapidly, and many have no trouble today pointing it out to you, you know, that you say what, when you say one thing and do another. And so there have been several times, more than I probably would like to admit, where somebody would come to me and said, yeah, but you said this other thing. How does that make sense here?
So, yes, that's actually been – and it was actually something I encouraged.
Yes, me too.
People to say that because it almost always pointed to us heading in the wrong direction as an organization. Mm-hmm. And it's interesting because – I was going to ask you, gentlemen, if either of you had looked or thought about Exhibit 1 and what message it conveys.
Are you talking about the diagram?
Yeah.
Yeah. It's called Forces Impinging Upon the Foreman.
Yeah, I thought that diagram was great. So what it looked to me was, so first of all, it looked a lot like Taylorism, because you have all these different things going on these different levels. And then you've also got this whole shadow side of the organization on the far right-hand side, where he's got the union officials and union representatives and shop stewards, you know, because at the time he's writing this, that was still in the early days of unionism. And I think maybe at this time they'd actually passed the National Labor Relations Act and some of those kinds of things, you know, but those were all very new. And so, yeah, I was thinking about one thing I was thinking is it was complicated. Then the other thing I was thinking was, well, maybe it's actually very simplified, because in some of the organizations Joe and I have worked in shipyards, whoa, it's a lot more complicated than some of that stuff, even though even with the union, right? And many times we would come into the organization and we would get a very logical explanation of the unions. I remember that. Because in some ways in my early days, I was a little bit antagonistic towards unions, because that's kind of what you see reported in the press. And then, of course, everybody reports like outrageous jury verdicts in the United States. That's what's get all the press, is some of the outrageous things you hear about with unions. But then when I saw I saw the way they functioned, and I saw some of the times management, you know, that, and thus like, technically my peers, were doing what I thought was outrageously unfair stuff. I started thinking, wow, you know, if men, maybe if men were angels, we would need unions, but I don't see any sign of that.
I just want to say something more regarding unions, more theoretical maybe, is, as you said, maybe because it was a specific point in time in which there was a lot of, you know, this player was very important still. But I think from a theoretical position, if you think here, we have both organization and management theory, and we have a bit of industrial relations as well. Because he is considering not only what is happening, you know, inside the organization, so on and so forth, but also the social level and the political struggle and the discussions that happens with, you know, representatives of labor and representatives of management, which is something that nowadays, well, one, because unions has gone down in a way in their power, especially in the US.
Yeah.
But I think it's something that has parted ways. You know, when people look at work and the employment dimension, and we usually, you know, people that do organization management theory look at the more work process in itself. But at this point in time, there was still this, they were integrated.
I was actually fascinated by it because it's a very cybernetic view of the relationship.
Oh, yes.
Oh, absolutely. That's a great way to say it.
Yeah.
And Ties, he had given us a hint very early on when he talked about the symptom by symptom attack will fail to go below the surface, showing his more systemic view. And in Exhibit 1, kind of lays it down right in front of people of, here's a systemic view of the organization and the challenges that we're looking at.
I don't know much about cybernetics, but I suspect that this came much after. So it's almost like, you know, before that kind of understanding emerged, he already was hitting at that.
So cybernetics was early in this stage, so Norbert Wiener and his merry men were developing cybernetics at the time.
Mm-hmm.
Whether he was actually aware or not, I don't know. But this is a typical view of that would have been produced at the time or shortly thereafter by Wes Churchman or Russell Ackoff,
okay,
of this kind of situation. So because of some of the other hints in his paper, like the recursion through the various levels, he's probably aware of some level of cybernetics.
And I think that connects well with what we were talking about earlier as far as this, the logics of bureaucracy and organizational construction, which I think is a great connection with cybernetics.
Mm-hmm.
And I think, and so Pedro, I'm just wondering, you know, you and I both tend to think more on the, or look more at the social aspects of the organization. So to me, while I think it's true, it strikes me as very sterile. although at the bottom, you can see at the bottom, he talks about requests for instruction, service and help and that sort of thing. But this idea of belonging, you know, and trust, that's nowhere in the diagram because I don't know if it fits in that conceptual view of an organization.
Can you present in a formal way things that are related to social dynamics? You know, because in a way, if you think he is, yes. I mean, this diagram is at the same time presenting you the formal hierarchy, but some of the issues that are inside nudging at the more social informal things, you know, the relation among foremen in a way. So I think the overall question is, once you put in a diagram like that, do you lose the richness and all the other issues that go beyond the formal system?
At the time, rich pictures in Checkland hadn't been created yet, so the tool might not have been available to portray that richness.
And I just think it's interesting that when you do try to reduce it to a diagram, like Pedro said, some of that richness just gets gobbled up or it's hard to describe. He does refer to it. It's just interesting. I think he has that, and maybe that was one of his purposes, to describe the formal structure that's going on and then later talk about how the social aspect is not acknowledged or recognized or doesn't flow through that very well. And I think he could have diagrammed that, but he just chose not to.
And he referred to the forces acting upon the foreman would be described in a text.
Yes.
So probably he felt that he needed words rather than a picture to describe some of that richness.
Right. And he goes on later in the article when he talks about the foreman situation summarized. He talks about these groups that he's dealing with. And he includes, I think he's referring back to that diagram. He's referring to the people that they work with, you know, the employees, the people who are these, this group of supervisors that don't work directly, don't tell the foreman how to do the day-to-day work, but they're the ones that author the policies and the quotas and some of those kinds of things, you know, people in HRD and finance those kinds. And then it's technical specialists who get in the details of how the work is actually done and where procedures are followed. And then he actually brings up top management as a separate group, you know, the people at the very top of the organizational hierarchy.
So thinking about the diagram and the different problems that, you know, the foreman faces with the different groups, to what extent do you think that it's still true in modern organizations?
And I think it is in some regards, where you have, because I've listened to my brother talk about some of the work that he did when he was working. And he would describe these situations where they'd have these meetings to make some change in the way the network was functioning. And they meet with the workers, and usually my brother could come to the meetings, but he wasn't allowed to speak. He had a boss who was able to speak. And I think they would get some briefing in advance of what was being proposed. And when the engineers are explaining what they want done, the people at the working level, I guess it would be my brother's supervisor. So I think he would be a foreman because my brother didn't supervise anybody below him. And they would say, well, that's not possible, or it can't be done because you've already done this or that, this other change. And he said what the reaction frequently from the technical specialists was disbelief and being stunned because what the foreman in this case had done, or the middle manager, is exposed their lack of knowledge. And so when my brother was relating some of these descriptions to me, I thought to myself, you know, it doesn't really sound like they care what the people at the working level think. It's more of a, here, we're just going to transmit this information to you because this is the medium it's easiest to do, but we're not really interested in what your view is. We're just telling you what we want. And then when the people brought up, when my brother's manager brought up that it couldn't be done, they didn't know what to do. You know, they're stunned.
So think, Ralph, because that was also often our experience. In a strategy both of us took was you didn't go plan for one of these emergent problems that was, you know, going to threaten the schedule and cost without having the people who were both going to execute it as well as the engineers in the room. Otherwise, you would end up with a solution that was unexecutable.
Yeah.
And or would take too long. And so that model, I think, is one to model for success and one to model for failure.
Yeah.
Are both out there. And it's until you've either learned the hard way and are willing to change to a different successful model that you do stupid things like issue a design change that hasn't been vetted through the welder. You know, therefore, no one says until it's issued, maybe even days or weeks after it's issued, oh, that welding process, there's no welder certified to do that welding process.
Right, so you can't do the work, right?
Right.
Yeah,
right.
Yeah. That's a great example, because I did learn the hard way. You know, I would tell people, it's like coming to tears. It almost made you want to cry because you – and Roethlisberger has this great line in here that made me think of that exact situation, Joe, where he says, for the foreman, you know, because of the nature of how work has changed, but this is just as true today, knowledge is not power. Now, he's overstating it slightly, but in many cases, you know, you could apply that to middle managers like Joe and I were, you know, just knowing what had to be done and what the deadline was, that wasn't good enough, you know, that we didn't have the knowledge, because I would say work is even more complex now than it was in the days that he's writing about this. And you learn very quickly as a foreman or middle manager, you do not have all the information. So yes, you either, and Joe and I both saw this. We saw people who, like us, figured out, oh, you better talk to people who do the real work, and they'll tell you what the gaps are. And they're happy to do so. They're happy to give you input. In fact, I got the sense they like to be consulted. So you get people who learn from that, and then you get these other people that basically just keep issuing orders and then get frustrated when what they want to have happen doesn't happen. It's pretty amazing.
So if I were to make an abstract point on what I'm hearing is that the same kind of dynamics and the same kind of problems would emerge in organizations today as long as there were two things in place that were in place in the situation Roethlisberger is describing. One is if the hierarchy only functions one directionally, you know, top-bottom, if there is no consultation with the ones on the ground doing the things, and also, from what I understand, if it is very segregated across departments, in which there is no real consultation with the different specialists. So then it's a recipe for disaster, in which you end up with strategies that no one can really implement, and you don't have the buy-in of the people that have to do the work.
Right. So a great illustration of that, that complexity across departments, is Navy ships will come into shipyards, and they get much more complex work performed on them with people with far greater skills than the average sailor. And that's normal. That's the way we set up the maintenance. And you would see, Joe and I both saw frustration amongst some of the senior officers of the crew, because what they wanted was, they said, I want one person in the shipyard to talk to. I want one person who's got the same span of control. And I actually had an officer tell me this, or ask me this. I want one person who's got the same span of control over the same functions I do, because it'll just be easier for me. And I didn't quite know how to react to that. So I went and talked to some people in the shipyard, and then I went, got some greater wisdom from them. And I went back to him and I said, that's not possible, because the nature of the work that we do in the shipyard is far more complex than what you do. And it's not feasible for one person to have your span of control for that kind of work. And therefore, no one person can know it all. And you're going to have to talk to a few other people. But because of the way the project management organization was set up, you know, I can be the conduit for most of that, but I don't have decision authority in those other areas, because they're the level of complexity of the work is too great.
Yes. And I'm sitting here thinking, though, so the question arises in my mind, given that we know what the problem is, and we'll talk about the solution, how come the problem keeps arising?
Oh, that's a great question.
Right? So why, and as a, you know, stuck in a Pedro, why in 1994, when both of us started our shipyard careers, had the systems not evolved to where we learned how to better lead and manage the work, rather than seeing repeated examples that would enable us to say for the first half of this paper that we've seen every one of those problems multiple times in the organizations that we worked at?
I think, but I don't know if I understand the whole issue correctly. The problem that, you know, the author is describing, the problems you are also, you know, reflecting upon, has to do with the way that the overall work system is set up, in which there is a hierarchy. And, you know, the way he put it here, people are supposed to administer, to uphold compliance over things that they themselves don't have a say in. And the people that are at the bottom doing the execution don't have a say either, you know, so it's a matter of autonomy. So you basically set up a system in which the people that are close to what is being done cannot use their brains to inform what is supposed to be done. You know, there is no participation, there is no general discussion on thinking what can be done. There is no use of the logic of the situation. There is a preset norms that has to be enforced in a preset way that has to be done, you know. So I think there is something about that, you know, once you're not prepared to give up autonomy and empower the people, you're always going to run into these kind of problems, if that makes sense.
Well, I think it does make sense. So the way I would characterize what I think I heard you say, which I thought was very insightful, is that the nature of the work in bureaucracy is this dividing work up into parts and pieces and specialization and those kinds of things. And when you look at the complexity of modern work, we tend to get carried away with the rules and processes and procedures that you mentioned. And undervalue and underweight what Joe brought up, which is the social relations aspect of it. And it is curious, and I think perhaps some of it is based on cultural norms. And I don't mean just cultural in the organization, but maybe national cultural norms. Because in America, for example, I know it's risky to generalize, but I'm going to. You know, we generally are looking for tools. We're very tool focused. You know, I have this problem. I want a tool. This will help me solve the problem, right? So whether it's quality circles or, you know, Kaizen or Kanban, you know, Americans just love tools. And one of the things, you know, you read every now and then, the Japanese managers and people from Toyota, they're a little amused, because to them, there's no tool that's sacred. Every tool is actually just a means at a particular time to work on a particular kind of difficulties. But what underlies, you know, the development of the tools they have is this development of the relationship with the worker, right? And having the worker be a partner in the work, maybe more craft-like than Taylorism. And so one of the things I'll bring up in the next episode is the fact that you see these, there's cultural differences in how shops are organized and how they treat the workers. And there's a couple of studies I'm going to refer to about that. But, you know, it is a head scratcher because Joe and I never learned, I think I can state that fairly strongly. We never learned in the formal management and even the leadership training that we got that the importance of those social relations. I mean, I think they were, a couple of things were kind of hinted at and came up every now and then, but very obliquely. And it was hard, you know, it's hard when you're a new person, whether you're learning to drive a car or drive a ship or function a shipyard, you know, you really want to know what the rules are because there's tons of them and you bump into them all the time. But learning the rules, I mean, just like for driving, they're only part of the solution. I mean, once you get the rules down, there's a whole bunch of other stuff that matter, like driver courtesy and deferring to other people and watching out for other people as in the case of driving. But also, so I had a shipyard commander, both Joe and I worked for him, and he used to say, you know, when you start some new project or you bring new people in, the first question they ask isn't what the rules are, right? Now he's talking about the people that do the work. He said, the first question they ask is, do you care about me? And of course, you can't answer that directly because it sounds simplistic to say, yes, I care about you, right? But the way you demonstrate that, as both Joe and I can relate, is, all right, so what are the working hours? Where do the workers get lunch? You know, how are you treating the workers through the lunch facilities? How often do the bathroom facilities, and I'll just keep high level, but how often are they cleaned, you know, such that they're in good conditions and workers have well-lighted places to work? You know, those kinds of things, what might be called the hygiene effects. You know, I think the Hawthorne study's narrow conclusion was, well, okay, when you pay attention to those things, those are important. I think you build trust by investing in those things because that sends a message. Yeah, I value you as a person. And it is curious, like Joe said, I don't know the reason for it, that even today, that's not something that's taught directly to people.
I love your point on the whole tools and the versus the underlying reason for doing certain things, because I think that you hit the nail in the head. You know, we transplant and then we change the way industrial organizations and organizations in general coordinate and divide up the work. But, you know, we bring things like quality circles and Kaizens and, you know, all those kind of things. But that's the point. It is a tool. The underlying issue is making the work more participative, yes, like empowering the worker, giving voice, capitalizing on the relationships that exist, nurturing them. But that, you know, is while it is the rationale behind, doesn't necessarily get, you know, promoted. And that's exactly the point, because management is done by learning a series of technique instead of, you know, as Follett would say, learning how to manage the law of the situation and getting to that together.
And that's all for part one of episode 33. Thank you for listening. We hope you're enjoying the discussion thus far and are finding it valuable. If so, please tell your friends, colleagues, and students who may be interested in these topics about the podcast. You can also get in touch with us on Twitter, Facebook, or via our website. Don't forget that we now have a newsletter that comes out the day after each episode and contains some bonus and unique content. You can subscribe to that using your email only on our website. Please join us next week as we release part two of this discussion about Roethlisberger's The Foreman, Master and Victim of Double Talk, here on Talking About Organizations.